food tastes better when it's free. They do that, and it does. Oh my goodness, it did. Yes, that's very lovely. Right, so we're moving on to our keynote. I realised this morning we didn't actually introduce Melissa this morning, so she was sat hidden among the people while you were all working, and so that was a really poor oversight on our part. So I just want to introduce you to Dr. Melissa Owen George. I'm from the University of Warwick. Melissa is a historian, and we kind of became attracted to her because recently the Royal Society, Historical Society, they published a report on the state of on race and racism in history education in Britain, which makes for a good read. If you've got a moment, just Google that. And it was very interesting, and it talked about the continuing underrepresentation of people from black and minority ethnic groups participating in history, and let alone succeeding in it and progressing through to it. And we were attracted to an article that Melissa wrote called Beyond Diversity, to kind of discuss some of those issues in there. And so we wanted to invite her to take part during the day. And we've asked Melissa if she would focus a little bit on her experience of anti-racist work, not only in Warwick, but much more broadly throughout her career within the Academy. So I will hand over. I hope I just summed that up properly. You're probably thinking I'm not doing that at all, aren't you? So just I should just kind of sneak away there, and you can tell them what you're really doing.
So I'm not going to do that exactly, but I am going to speak very specifically about Warwick and actually just a very sort of specific program that I've been involved in. But I'm going to try to stick to my script, because I think if I don't, I might end up taking the whole hour.
That's fine. Before you continue, just to remind people, Melissa has asked if we don't take photos of the slides, because there is a particular piece of work on there which is not public yet, so she doesn't want it on Twitter. So no photos. Please.
It's not that exciting, I just need to make sure that...
apart from you, you can click that, because then we can edit yours, that's fine, no worries.
So I'm going to start by... thank you for inviting me to speak here. I'm hoping... by the number of very similar events happening at universities and departments and faculties across the country, that there is change happening. I hope that's what that means. I'm excited because I feel like we might be moving in a very positive direction. And I want to start with that positivity, actually. And I hope that what we're witnessing truly is, to quote Stuart Hall, a slow-moving revolution towards equity in higher education in our larger society. So today I'm sharing some of the work that I've been doing at Warwick, specifically the development of a program on anti-racist pedagogy for staff that I was directly involved in developing. And the point of this program is to equip staff to create transformational liberatory change in their practice and within the institution. So I hope that there are examples here that may be of use to you as you work on transforming your own institutions. But there might also be opportunities for synergies, for collaborations and joining up. And actually, the more talks I do, the more I think that there needs to be some kind of national anti-racist network and sort of pedagogy, something like that. And lastly, just to say, I appreciate this opportunity because in preparing this paper, it allowed me to sort of take stock of the work on anti-racist pedagogy that I've been involved in over the last couple of years. So thank you for that. So as Sharon said, that I'm a historian. I'm a historian of race in the Caribbean and in history at the University of Warwick. My historical research is concerned with how people work within and negotiate structures of inequality. The everydayness, the subtle strategies that people use that can lead to transformational societal and cultural change. But more recently, my work has been predominantly pedagogical, which, to be honest, has been motivated by my appointment 3 years ago to a position called Director of Student Experience, which I'm... Does anyone know? I don't think this translates beyond Warwick. Basically, it's... I have, like, 60% of my contract was bought out... and it's a kind of professional services role that's focusing on developing strategy and programming to engage students. And it's really in this role that I became more involved with working towards dismantling racist processes and procedures within higher education, because much of my time What I saw was that issues around the awarding gap, not I like to call it the awarding gap opposed to the attainment gap for Black students, was one of the major issues in student experience, right? And so from that, I started to look at some of the pedagogical changes that needed to happen. I already said that I was going to stay. I've already gone off script. I already lost my place, and I'm like 2 minutes in. Right, so that's the work that I... So I'm a historian, and I bring that into some of the work that I do, but really a lot of the work I'm doing is around a strategy and development within the institution. So just to say that I'm not a one-woman army here, although sometimes it does feel like that in the institution, but I'm a part of an ever-growing community of anti-racist practice at the University of Warwick that involves people at different positions of the institution, from student-led initiatives such as the Decolonize Project, which is aimed at working with staff to review curriculum, to the appointment of a director of social inclusion, to various decolonizing the library initiatives, right? So there's all throughout the different stages of the institution, people, I think, are working towards decolonizing, but also sort of pushing an anti-racist agenda. So this is really where my involvement with creating institutional change centers. It's on creating cultural change within the institution, mostly through pedagogical intervention. And while I'm involved in other things, most recently co-chairing the university's first race equality task force, what I want to discuss in more in depth with you here is a new staff development program that we're hoping to begin piloting early next year, called Tackling Racial Inequality at Warwick University. Now, I want to say, so we're at the stage right now where this program is being reviewed for institutional funding, a strategic fund, and I feel quite positive about it. I think it might actually go through. And part of the reason I think it might go through is because we've been really careful about how we frame it and the language that we use. So even the title of this program was really well thought out, right? It is Tackling Racial Inequality at Warwick University. Nobody can argue with tackling racial inequality, right? Opposed to anti-racist pedagogy, right? So everything that we've done here has been quite strategic, I think. But before I share with you the details of the program, I want to share with you the journey, right? So how the program was developed, the understandings of race and racism and anti-racism that it's at its heart. And so essentially, I want to show you our scaffolding and some of our negotiations. Okay, so Tackling Racial Inequality at Warwick University. This program came out of a teaching academy, actually. Came out of a teaching academy at the university, within the University of Warwick, called the Warwick International and Higher Education Academy, or WIHIA, as it's most commonly known. And I realized that, WIHIA is its own thing. I don't even know why it's called Warwick International Higher Education. Like, I'm not certain about the title, but sticking to the script. But it's quite unique, I think. And so it's a body independent within from the center of the university. I suppose sort of like a college here, come to think of it, the way the college system works here. So its express function is advancing critical and reflective pedagogical practice. And here are some details about it, right? So it's the first institutional academy of educators. In order to become a member of this academy, it's like a process. You become a fellow. There's, it's collective institutional voice and so on. The people who are involved in WIHIA are sort of span the whole institution. So students, there are student fellows, but there's also some of the most, like the education, several members of the education executive are also fellows within the academy, right? So it's this sort of quite flat, I suppose, in many ways, academy. Now, WIHIA hosts several learning communities or learning circles made up of fellows of the academy on a range of pedagogical topics that we identify as being important to the university. And so some examples or some examples of the work that these learning circles that are part of the academy have done has been, for instance, restructuring the promotion process within the University of Warwick. And so now at the University of Warwick, those on teaching contracts and those on research teaching contracts, there's complete parity in terms of pay and other kinds of things, right? And leave and so on, right? So I'm giving this example to say that Wahia and these learning circles have actually been quite influential over the past couple of years in terms of changing the structures within the university. So when I became a fellow 2 years ago, I had already been part of an informal community of anti-racist students and staff developing workshops and such on racism on campus. My interest was quite focused on, as I said, on the attainment or the awarding gap. As you may know or may not know, various reports, including the report that Sharon mentioned, the Royal Historical Society report, that was published last year, highlighted the extent of racial discrimination, racial violence within the history departments, and it showed a clear and substantial difference in the attainment, the progression, and overall experience of students who identify as Black, Asian, and minority ethnic, but especially students who identify as Black and specific Asian communities, compared to those who identify as white. Now, history, the RHS report is actually, I think, was quite late to the discussion. There's been a larger, much longer discussions. I think 2009, the NUS published a similar report about the Warden Gap and these sort of the manifestation of white supremacy, I suppose, the impact of that on students in terms of their experience. But I think right now we're at the point where it's quite widely accepted that the disparity in outcome and experience reflected in the research cannot be attributed to any kind of cultural deficit among students of color, but that it's a direct result of practices and processes within the university itself that disadvantage specific communities of students. Now, some of these studies, we ourselves have done several studies at Warwick that are specific to Warwick, and one specific area of concern in these studies at Warwick, but also across the sector, has been teaching practice, right? Content, yes, but also the environment, how people teach, how we actually manage the classroom, how the seminars are set up, and so on, that this has been, I think, quite consistently highlighted as one of the areas that contributes negatively to the experience of students of color and, by extension, the attainment or the awarding gap. Now, because of this, myself and my colleague, Dr. NL Westy, who is also a fellow of this academy, we formed a learning circle that is called Anti-Racist Pedagogy and Practice. So Anti-Racist Pedagogy and Practice in Higher Education Learning Circle. Now, this learning circle, in terms of how we understand anti-racist pedagogy, we understand this in terms of three components. Probably the most popular, the incorporation of topics of race and inequality into course content, right? This is the sort of decolonizing that we often, I think, many of us talk about. Teaching from an anti-racist pedagogical approach, what that means, right? What does it mean to teach in that kind of way? And anti-racist organizing within the university and linking to the wider community, right? So the idea that you cannot, whatever we're doing in the institution can't just sit within the institution, that it has to have far, that it has to go beyond the boundaries of the university. Now, so we were very conscious of the amount of effort spent and time spent within Warwick, but other institutions, and I think it strikes me in Cambridge as well, it seems, on the first part here, right? On this sort of the incorporation of topics around race, talking about course content. And so we decided not to focus mostly or just upon course content. Instead, and perhaps more challenging, is the way that we teach and engage outside of the classroom. This is what we've learned from several of the study student reports on BME student experience and so on that I've already mentioned. And a lot of the stuff that was coming out of the workshops that we were doing with staff at Warwick, that the way that they teach, incorporating anti-racist pedagogy in their teaching, that was the challenge, right? How to actually live this, how to actually practice this, that was the challenge. But this is also a recognition of the ongoing processes in order to create transformational change, right? So content is something that can, as easily as it can be changed, it can be changed back. We just see this as, we really wanted to do something that was, that was more embedded. So change in thinking about the way that people teach, we thought that would be a more embedded way of creating this kind of transformational change. Okay. Now, the aims of the Learning Circle. Oh. Hold on a second. So the aims of the Learning Circle was to, laid out here, inform institutional deliberations, the creation of inclusive classrooms through the engagement and practice of anti-racism. We've used the word inclusive quite a bit throughout this, and embedded anti-racist pedagogy across the institution. This Learning Circle was the most popular Learning Circle that Wahia had, with 19 fellows who wanted to be involved in this. There are 3 student fellows. We met a couple times a term as a larger group, but then there were other sub-groups, working groups. And just to add, though, these are our 3 official aims of this Learning Circle. Informally, though, I would say that one of the central aims of this Learning Circle was also to move that institutional discussion from diversity and unconscious bias to white supremacy and racism. We didn't write that. We couldn't write that, right? Like, we weren't going to write that down, right? But in our discussions and the way that we were talking about things, we were very clear that we were not, this was not going to be about diversity, and it was not going to be about unconscious bias. Right. So underlaying our thinking around this, then, is critical race theory. So these are the key points for us. But I also really like this quote by Angela Davis that goes, in a racist society, it's not enough to be non-racist, we must be anti-racist. And what I like most about this quote is the way in which she turns sort of commonplace understanding of racism on its head. Racism is not just what is said or done. On the contrary, because racism is so historically embedded in the structures and cultures of our society, it's our inactivity that allows its continuation and perpetuation. In other words, we are complicit. We're all complicit. Unless we're actively challenging it. Unless we're actively anti-racist. And there are there are no non-racist people, in other words, right? Like, you're not, there's no one is not racist or non-racist. There are not bad apples. So really pushing throughout this whole program and the Learning Circle, but also the program that we've developed, we're pushing against this idea that if we, you know, that the problems are a few people, a few bad apples, and that me, because I don't know, read the Guardian and, you know, do the occasional protest or whatever the signal is for that people sometimes use for non-racist, that somehow I'm exempt from this system, right? Racism, ideas of whiteness as superior, ideas of hierarchy, of racial categorizations and power, these are all, described these things as sort of microorganisms in the air, floating in the air, in our water, poisons that we're all consuming. So we're all part of this thing that is historically embedded, culturally, society, right, shapes our institutions. Therefore, we all have a responsibility to unlearn this. This is an idea of racism, I think, that is very historical. And I often, one of the things that I find really challenging is how the discussions around racism in higher education, even anti-racism, though, how ahistorical those discussions often are. And as a historian, that's really good. Anyway, so we've had to be quite firm around our approach. So we're not promoting diversity or multiculturalism. We understand the problem not solely as the absence of brown and black broad bodies, but more embedded issue of racist white supremacy and power, right? So historical. And this is uncomfortable. We found that this is incredibly uncomfortable for individuals and institutions who are often more comfortable talking about diversity. And that's, I think, also partially because institutions have a major role to play in the creation, perpetuation, and reinforcement of these kinds of inequalities, historically and today. And so diversity becomes, for us, my opinion, diversity becomes a trap. And this trap that we really wanted to try and avoid. So I actually find myself increasingly pushing back against initiatives where the sole purpose seems to be diversity. Diversity in terms of the curriculum, even. So I don't really like to spend lots of time talking about how to decolonize your curriculum, as in your course content. For me, that's important, but that's not where I want to focus my attention, I suppose. And I feel like that actually, even in the response to the Royal Historical, so the report that the Royal Historical Society produced was quite extensive, and it included a whole range of suggestions of how you can embed, or how you can sort of create, you can change the culture of your institution, right? From heads of departments to teaching staff to all different, you know. And the kind of attention it gave, the focus, was almost purely on the question of curriculum, the content of curriculum. In terms of the media response and everything else, was about the, and so I feel like that becomes the fixation. And so we really, you know, I really want to push against that and move away from that. Again, off script, and now I've lost my place. Okay. So, right, so I'm pushing against diversity. So my main issue with diversity initiatives and agendas in UK higher education is simply this, that diversity becomes the objective, right? It becomes the end game. The purpose is to increase diversity, to diversify, to move, to have more brown and black faces in your institution, on your reading list, in your classrooms. And there's nothing wrong with this, really. However, diversity is not and cannot be used as a stand-in for equity. And I fear that this is the case. The narrative grows. If you have diversity, then you have equity in the institution. And if you have racial equity, then you have anti-racism or the absence of racism. And that's not true. Right? You can have an incredibly diverse institution and still have the same kinds of inequalities that we are seeing. Now, in addition to that, or more than that, perhaps, I believe that we're in a moment, and we must be conscious that the focus now within higher education on decolonizing and diversity, that this is a very temporary moment. I think that this is a temporary moment. So in 1980, Derek Bell Jr., a scholar integral to the development of critical race theory, he published an article called Brown versus Board of Education and the Interest Convergence Dilemma in the Harvard Law Review. And in this article, Bell argued that the outcome of the Brown versus Board of Education case, this is the case that deemed racial segregation in the U.S. as unconstitutional in 1954, was not decided based upon the Supreme Court's commitment to racial equality, but rather at the moment in U.S. politics, it was in the best interest of the state, of the establishment, to rule against the Board of Education. And Bell wrote, the decision in Brown to break with the court's long-held position on these issues cannot be understood without some consideration of the decision's value to whites, not simply those concerned about the immorality of racial inequality, but also those whites in policymaking positions able to see the economic and political advantages at home and abroad that would follow abandonment of segregation. And he goes on to discuss advantages towards the U.S. credibility on the international arena, in the face of war against communism, and so on. And so this is a very cynical, perhaps, understanding of moves towards equality. However, we can see this historically, I think, in terms of things like the abolition of slavery. So Eric Williams' thesis is essentially that the abolition in Britain occurred not because of the moral humanitarian movement, but because slavery was no longer economically advantageous to Britain, right? So this is what Derek Bell, I think, would call an interest convergence. And the reason I'm bringing it up here and in this context is because I believe that we are in one of these moments when the interest of the institution is in line with the interest of staff and students, or some staff and students. But as history has shown us, and I believe, that these moments, these alignments are only momentary, and often the changes that result, the commitments towards equality, are often only temporary. The state or the institution will often claw back the rights and gains achieved over time as much as it can. And I think that's why we see, you know, in the sort of early 80s, certain moves towards anti-racism, and then they're gone, and then they, right? I think we see this repeatedly throughout history. So because of certain, I suppose, in this moment now, we have things like the TEF, right? We have the Office for Students setting certain standards around attainment, saying that the institutions must commit to closing the attainment gap. We have these different things happening across the sector that is allowing certain changes to happen, or potentially certain changes to happen within the institution. But those changes are not going to be guaranteed, I think, in the next few years. That space will not last for that long. So I think that what we need to do is think quite strategically about how to embed things, how to embed the changes that we want to see. And so if we ended with diversity, more people of colour in the institution, but no actual change to the institution, I fear that when this moment has passed, when it's no longer in the interest of the institution to commit itself to addressing racism, to addressing widening participation, to addressing all of these other kinds of inequalities, that I'm not going to read what I wrote there, but we're just going to be in a bad position. Right? So the institution may be opening up now, but it can just as quickly close its doors. Thus, I think we should be focusing our attentions on what we can do radically to change the institution, the structures, and the cultures that allow for racism to persist, for racism to become embedded and normalized, to go unseen within when backs are turned. And this requires, I think, a multifaceted approach, many actors working at different parts of the institution connected to wider actions outside of the university. And as far as I can see, this can only be achieved through an active anti-racist agenda, and active in rooting out racial thinking that shapes and structures our society, institutions, and ourselves. So I'm really interested in changing and how, like, changing the way people think about race and think about racism. That, to me, is really important. Right, and so this is the thinking that has shaped the staff development program. I keep putting it in quotation because I actually hate it that we call it a staff development program, but it fits within the university's culture, I suppose, at the moment. It's one of the things that we sort of conceded, I guess. And it's still in quite early stages. So what it is a series of modules, 3-hour modules over the course of a year. It includes 3 core modules, 5 additional optional modules. It's very specific to Warwick. So it uses Warwick examples. It talks about Warwick data. It speaks to the different culture and the systems and processes within Warwick specifically. And it's targeting teaching staff. That's both academic staff and professional services staff that are in student-facing positions. The overall objectives of this program. So we wanted to create a space that's supportive, not necessarily safe, but supportive, for staff to work through their shit, essentially, right? So to unlearn and to unpower, to create change, and so on. So the overall objectives are here. I think I heard someone mention earlier about staff saying that staff often say that they want to do something, but they don't know what to do, so they don't do anything, right? That definitely came up in the workshops that we ran with staff. Right, this sense of like disempowerment that yes, we know we should be doing something, we know we want to do something, but we just don't know. So what happens in that classroom when, you know, someone says something racist? What do you do? I don't know. Like, I don't know. I just don't say anything. That kind of comments were coming out of the workshops. And so this program really is about taking away that excuse. Right. Now, the outline of the program. These are rough titles, I should say. These are draft titles. These are not actually the titles that are going to be, but generally, it's the outline of the program. Now, this program was developed by, it was led by myself and my colleague, Anil, but it was developed by 10 members of staff. So in addition to the consultations that we did with students and members of staff, this outline itself was developed with 10 members of the Anti-Racist Pedagogy and Process Learning Circle. So these are people who were already reading the studies and doing some of the readings and thinking about this over the course of a year. And just this last summer, we put together this. It included both academic professional services staff and students. It took us 2 days to come up with this program. And not the detail, I should say, not the, like, the actual course content is still, we're hoping will be developed over the next few months, but just sort of the general outline and learner objectives and so on was developed over 2 days, so it was a lot of time. Right, okay, so this is where we are now then with this program. So we are, so this draft program was actually included within the university's social inclusion strategy. So this is a document that outlines what the university will commit to over the, I think, the next 5 years and what the kinds of things it will support. The director of social inclusion basically signed off and supported this program and included it in the university's strategy. So it's already in that way embedded. The Learning Circle has established an anti-racist teaching forum that will support teaching staff that come out of this program, but also teaching staff more generally.